Christmas music can be a little bit like old paintings that have lost some of their original bright colors. What do some of those pieces sound like when you peel away all those years of remakes and adaptations? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Engaged in our exercise in restoration, which really just gives us an excuse to gather around the keyboards on Christmas, are harpsichordist and pianist Trevor Stevenson and four singers, including Rachel Edie Warwick, soprano, Jessica Timmon, alto, Peter Gritt, tenor, and bass Nathan Krieger.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Hello.
It'll be a pleasure to hear some music today. Let's start, Trevor, by asking about the history of Christmas carols. How far back do we go before we find the tradition of singing, caroling?
Oh, you know, some of that would be guesswork. We know we have some of the established Christmas pieces come from the Middle Ages or the late Middle Ages. We're actually going to start with one that is probably 8th century, O Come Emmanuel. And of course, you know, I think people, it's such a wonderful holiday and people gather together and singing was always a part of it.
So what is it about O Come Emmanuel that makes it sound so ancient and yet so fresh too? Is it in a slightly weird mode for modern standards?
Yeah, right. It's the, you know, in technical terms, it's the absence of the leading tone, right? Which doesn't mean a lot if you don't speak music, but what the idea is that the, you know, the home note is E in this piece. And then when you go down below the home note, you have a lot of what they call a flat seventh degree. We're used to this. But in O Come Emmanuel, it's that scale, right? Which is a very ancient sounding scale. It's an old church mode. And of course, the tune itself just seems to come from eternity as well.
And then when you harmonize it, how do you go about that?
Right. Now, the harmonization was added much later, probably in the 17th or 18th century, and that's the harmonization we all know. We're actually going to do this as a vocal solo with the soprano to open, so just the line, probably the way it was done for a long time. The tune is so wonderful, it holds water, certainly on its own. And then we'll bring in the more relatively modern harmonization of it in four parts.
O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel, that mourns in lonely exile here, until the Son of God appear. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel.
O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel, that mourns in lonely exile until the Son of God appear. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel.
That's so beautiful. What is it about the four-part nature of that, you know, the soprano, alto, tenor, bass, that's so pleasing, would you say, Trevor?
I as an instrumentalist, I want to always say the human voice rules, you know. It is, my grandmother always said that the human voice is closest to God, and then you move out from there. But it's just the way partly the intonation that you can get with a vocal quartet. They're singing most of the time in what we call just intonation, which means that the intervals are pure. They're moving the pitches around to where they get a lock, a harmonic lock. And you combine that with the warmth of the human voice, it really goes to the stars. So, you know, besides that, we don't know what it is, but it sure spells mother, doesn't it?
And that combination soprano, alto, tenor, bass is, I guess, one of the most common vocal configurations, isn't it?
Yes, right. And you know, tried and true. It's worked for centuries.
Just out of curiosity, are there other pieces that have the same kind of mode that are even in the repertory today?
Oh, you know,
it sounds
von
so
Himmel hoch, from heaven above, I have come, you know, the old German tune,
right.
That's got some modality.
What's the next piece we're going to hear sung a cappella by this group of four singers?
It's Adoramus Te, which is a Palestrina piece, a great Renaissance composer from Italy, and this is a setting of, you know, Adoramus Te, we worship thee, to the baby Jesus.
There's a story about Palestrina and the Pope, and the Pope wanted music that was clear to understand, easy to figure out what the words were, because they were so important, of course, in the church context, and mm-hmm. Palestrina was the winner, hands down, when it came to supplying that. What is it that makes Palestrina so clear, do you think?
Right. And of course, at that time, there was all sorts of rebellion going on for writing very polyphonic music,
right,
in which the text was difficult to understand, right? But Palestrina, as I understand it, you're saying he was a favorite of the Pope's,
yes,
for keeping the text clear. That piece is not terribly imitative. I mean, that's somewhat homophonic, and it's everyone's moving at the same rate, and the words are generally moving at the same time like that. But he does it without making it seem chunky, you know, which is really a miracle, you know, because the lines are still independent and everybody's part makes linear sense. So that's part of his miracle.
Most Christmas carol books are divided into sort of contemporary ones like Jingle Bell Rock, and then there's always a section called traditional. What are some traditional Christmas carols that have kind of a old history?
Now, if I get it right this time, I think our next one is, right, which is Lo, How a Rose E'er Blooming, right, which is an old, I think, a German carol. And this one is, this harmonization we're going to hear of the tune is by Praetorius, a 17th century master. And so, anyway, it's the harmonization we've all heard, and it works in any combination with brass instruments and orchestra, but a particular favorite for the vocal quartet. Here it is.
Lo, how a rose e'er blooming from tender stem hath sprung, of Jesse's lineage coming, as men of old have sung. It came a floweret bright amid the cold of winter, when half spent was the night. Isaiah twice foretold it, the rose I have in mind. With Mary to men a Savior, when aspect endures as a night.
I don't think to this day I've heard it in any language except for English, and even more commonly in German under Es ist ein Rose entsprungen, and it has a German sound. It's hard to imagine it in other than a Germanic language somehow.
Right. One of the great tunes. So one of those tunes that gets in your head, it can stay there for weeks.
Another favorite is The Holly and the Ivy. What kind of arrangement do you have of that one?
Well, it may not even be the tune you're thinking of. Right? This is the old French carol version. So this is not the typical Holly and the Ivy, but an old and in some ways a modal type of version of it. We don't even know what century this came from. But it has a great mood, and the words of the singing of the choir and the running of the deer, and is kind of an outdoors feeling to it. And I think we're doing this in D minor.
The holly and the ivy now both are full well grown. Of all the trees that are in the wood, the holly bears a crown. Oh, the rising of the sun, the running of the deer, the playing of the merry organ, sweet singing in the choir, sweet singing in the choir. The holly bears a blossom as white as lily flower, and Mary bore sweet Jesus Christ to be our sweet Savior. Oh, the rising of the sun, the running of the deer, the playing of the merry organ, sweet singing in the choir, sweet singing in the choir.
That's intriguing because, as you say, Trevor, it is different from the tune that we usually associate with those lyrics. It works just as well. It has maybe a slightly different kind of intensity to it.
Yeah, definitely a darker cast, yeah.
And it makes you wonder, usually it's the tune that has a whole bunch of different words, like Greensleeves has something like 60 different sets of lyrics to it. But in this case, it's the lyrics that have more than one tune. That seems a little more unusual.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. It's always when I was a kid playing the piano and learning all these Christmas carols, I came back to this page over and over again. It's just it's riveting. Yeah.
Well, it had a very haunting sound. It was more in the minor key than the usual one that we're used
absolutely.
To.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I wish I knew where it came from. Going to switch worlds, right?
We'll switch worlds in just a moment. And we're going to bring in the harpsichord and go into the good old 18th century with Johann Sebastian Bach when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests, Trevor Stevenson, and he is at the harpsichord for this part of our conversation. He'll be at the piano later. With us also, soprano Rachel Edie Warwick, alto Jessica Timmon, tenor Peter Gritt, and bass Nathan Krieger. And we're looking at Christmas music through the ages and getting a look at it as it might originally have been performed in most cases. We've looked hitherto at works by unknown composers, ancient works going back to the 17th century and farther. But as we get into the 18th century, I know there is quite a bit of Baroque Christmas music of one kind or another, Trevor.
Right, right. And these pieces we'll do here, of course, are by Bach. They're his harmonization of tunes that were collected by a colleague of his named Shemeli, right? So Shemeli had the tunes collected. He said to Bach, can you help me out with good harmonizations? Bach said, I have a half hour. Sure. You know, yeah, right. You know, and he wrote these on. No, he probably cranked these out pretty fast. He was the master of this four-part writing at the keyboard. And this would have been an album for home enjoyment, a publication for people to make music at home the way that they did for centuries, from really the time the harpsichord was invented in the 14th or 15th century up through the 18th century, people singing and people playing, and then somebody playing at the instrument behind them.
In German?
In German, yeah. And these are all German songs that were, I'm sure, known inside out by the Lutheran constituency. Yeah.
So these will be from that same collection that Bach harmonized for.
Right, and it's now known as the Shemeli Notebook. This, if you're looking for it, you're Googling it, right? So it's a.
So the tune would be by Shemeli, and the harmonization by Bach.
The tune, actually, most of them are not by Shemeli. They're tunes that everybody would have known. They're hymn tunes and other spiritual songs. I don't. In fact, this one is written by Johann Kruger, perhaps Nathan's great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, right, from the 17th century. So this was just a way of getting them out there to people in a printed form.
And in this first one that we're going to hear, what are the lyrics telling us?
This one is perk up, buck up, right?
The Savior
is here, yeah. And, take heart.
Ämpfe dich, mein schwacher Geist, und trage groß Verlangen. Ein kleines Kind, das Vater heißt, mit Freuden zu empfangen. Dies ist die Nacht, darin es kam, und menschlich Wesen an dich nahm, dadurch die Welt mit Treuen all seine Braut zu freien. Lobpreis und Dank, Herr Jesu Christ, sei dir von mir gesungen, dass du mein Bruder worden bist und hast die Welt erschwungen. Hilf, dass ich deine Gütigkeit stets preis in dieser Gnadenzeit und möge auch dort oben in Ewigkeit dich loben.
When I think about these pieces, then the way you describe them, Trevor, as being for home use and, harpsichord and a couple of home singers, it really seems then it's a middle-class phenomenon.
Yeah, right. And I guess the publishing revolution of that's really getting rolling by the 18th century is addressing middle-class purchasing in a way, yeah. And this is house music, yeah. It's meant to be enjoyed by people, just in their home and
before the
computers
invention
and
of
TV,
the invention of video.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you do? You sing Bach.
Right, you make it yourself. Exactly.
And before the piano comes along, which we're much more accustomed to hearing, we've got this harpsichord, which I know is difficult sometimes to pick up on with a recording without it sounding very tinny or tinkling. From your standpoint, Trevor, as someone who has worked to restore harpsichords, recorded on the harpsichord, what is the special quality that you get from hearing a voice with harpsichord that we're not going to get when we go to the piano?
Right. Of course, the harpsichord, it's a very thin wire plucked by a little pick. In this case, it's actually a bird's feather. It's a crow feather and all that. And its object is to get the pitch into the air as fast as possible and in a rhythmic manner. And by doing that, it provides this almost a blueprint for the singer to then flesh out the structure from. So that's the harpsichord's role. This is actually the harpsichord I'm playing was made here in Madison by Norman Shepherd. It's a 17th century Dutch model. There's even a famous Vermeer painting in which you can see but not hear this instrument at work. It's called The Concert, and there's a young woman playing it and a young woman singing, and there's a guy playing a lute along with it. But that's how it was really very much of a chamber instrument.
We have a tenor up at the mic. What are we going to hear from Peter Gritt?
Yeah. We'll be hearing Ich steh an deine Krippen hier. Another one of the Christmas pieces.
And what do the lyrics mean?
It's more of a
by the cradle.
I stand by your cradle, O Jesulein, mein Leben, O Christ, my love. And he goes on to talk about the sort of the redemption that Christ is bringing, and the sin that's being wiped away.
Yeah, exactly. And we spoke of the lute just a second ago. I'm going to use my lute imitator stop here on this harpsichord, which is...
That's nice.
Yeah, right. Sounds pleasantly plucky.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and it's just a very, very kind of a soft breeze kind of a feel.
Does that harpsichord have other instrumental imitator stops as well, or
now,
just the lute?
There's that, and then there's an additional set of strings that are a 4-foot register, which can add brightness to it, which you use mostly for playing in large public settings like that. Kind of like adding a piccolo to a band. It makes it carry more, but... And here we don't need it.
And later on, though, these harpsichords would get... So they had a lot of bells and whistles
exactly.
To the point where they were trying to, I guess, compete with the new kid on the block, that forte piano. And
exactly.
They could imitate, what, trumpets and oboes and all kinds of things.
Yeah, whereas this is really at the end of the period where the harpsichord was content with itself, you know. and it was all about sweetness and pitch. And this instrument weighs 95 pounds. It's under 100 pounds. And they probably also it has an incredibly heavy top to it. I'm sure the Dutch used it for a table as well when it was closed. So we'll do. So this is the Bach song, Ich steh an deine Krippen hier. Good.
Ich steh an deine Krippen hier, O Jesulein, mein Leben. Ich stehe, bring und schenke dir, was du mir hast gegeben. Nun hin, es ist mein Geist und Sinn, Herr Seel und Mut, nimm alles hin und lass dir's wohl gefallen. Ich lag in dieser Todesnacht, du wurdest meine Sonne, die Sonne, die mir zu gebracht, Licht, Leben, Freud und Wonne. O Sonne, die das hätte Licht des Glaubens in mir zugericht, wie schön sind deine
Are the songs in this collection, these harmonizations by Bach, are they in any particular order? Is there a structure to the collection? When you say notebook, it implies that there might not be.
Yeah, they're organized by often by season, or the way old hymnals were often organized by philosophical intent. You know, these are from the Christmas section. I think there's some songs for for Good Friday, Easter, spiritual uplifting, you know, and all of that. So that was the way the collection, you know, was pulled together.
Songs for all spiritual needs.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that was your yellow pages for the song. How to find it.
I like the way we're hearing from each of the different voices, starting with bass and then tenor and now moving to alto. After hearing the four of them together in a quartet, it's kind of nice to hear the voices separately. And alto has such a nice, rich quality. What are we going to hear by Jessica Timmon?
Say a word about it. No, okay, right. Oh, this is another Christmas piece, and this is very much in the minuet style. So it's in a very kind of a stately dance rhythm. And you said something about alto and all that. I should say something about the pitch here. We're tuned a half step lower than modern pitch, which is called 4/15. So it is a particularly chewy alto world that we are in, you know. Right, yeah. But all the more chocolatey because of it. So it's nice for singing, you know. And even in Bach's Leipzig, where he lived, there was probably four different pitches that you could encounter in one day. You could have this 4/15 pitch. There would be 390 at court often with the woodwind instruments, 440, and then 460 for the organ at church.
440 being the current default.
Right, right. So just imagine how complex it was. And for the singers as well, and the violinists, right? And, of course, the old joke was that the flute players had at least five joints in their case, which they still do.
Yeah. Well, yeah, one would hope everyone knew what the reigning pitch was for that particular moment. But what are the lyrics that we're going to be hearing in this piece?
This one, this is kind of about the firmament and Jesus, you know, coming down. So it's an airy, the image is airy. It's just about how from heaven it comes.
Ihr Gesicht
have any kind of record of what these songs sounded like before Bach harmonized them?
I don't know. I mean, of course, the tunes existed, right? And there were probably other harmonizations, right? But I don't know how far afield he went, you know, in doing this, right? But again, this is a very 18th century kind of style that he's writing in here. This is, you know, French, kind of almost like Lully, right? Uh-huh. The harmonization is here. So I imagine this is pretty au courant, you know, this is pretty modern, which they would have liked. Bach and his contemporaries loved taking, you know, old wine and putting it in new skins. That was something that they enjoyed.
The song we were hearing was about sort of reaching up to heavens, kind of up in the air. Now we're moving up to the soprano, getting up even higher.
Yes.
What are the lyrics going to be about in the fourth song from this Schemelli notebook?
So this piece is called O Jesulein Süß, which means sweet Jesus, a sweet little Jesus.
Right.
And it is talking about how Jesus is sweet and mild and repeats that fairly often, and then talking about all the things that he did for us. So he stilled your father's wrath, he pays for our guilt, he's filled our world with joy, he has comforted us in our sorrow, all the beautiful things that he did, and then always repeats at the beginning, at the end of every verse, O Jesulein Süß, O Jesulein Mild, which means mild.
Mm-hmm. And again, sort of in the minuet style.
Oh, yeah.
songs in the whole collection, roughly?
Not sure. 50, 60?
Wow.
Something like that. Yeah. And no, it's amazing. And Bach, of course, really brought his A game to these, you know, harmonizations. He always did, but these are just particularly beautiful. It's a great collection. I don't know if it's been recorded more than once or twice. It's waiting.
yeah. I mean, I can't say as I've come across it. Does he specify a stop for the harpsichord in very many of these, or is it that one with the lute?
No, I just made that up.
You made that up.
Yeah, right. They would have expected you to make it up. I mean, that was to find things that were artistically interesting and suitable for the piece. Yeah. The joke is, if you have to ask, you shouldn't be playing it, right? So, you know, that's one reason they don't give too many directions in it, right? And a lot of these were he just provided figures for. That is, it was just a figured bass. That is, so you had the bass line and the numbers, which was the fake book of the day, and then you were supposed to artistically make it up on top of that, which they did from the time they could. From the time they could walk, they trained them.
Baseline is like a template. Okay, so you use this one, and then you personalize it. And
right.
So it's almost sort of like a form of karaoke in a way.
Right. No, it is, and it was done for centuries. And we know that they trained from day one at the keyboard in how to do this from the figures. And we also know that by the middle of the 19th century, after the piano takes over and the harpsichord and even the organ are beginning to take a back seat, this art is lost by the 1850s or 60s. There's a wonderful story about Brahms looking for somebody who was good reading figures for a piece like that. They couldn't find anybody, you know. So even in a few generations, it can disappear.
You mentioned that most of this music would have been performed in houses, sort of the chamber music idea. But with the theme and the beauty of the music, it makes me wonder, you know, would they not also have been performed at churches?
I think so. The church was a long service full of musical needs, and we don't know what they did at churches. Very seldom did they have a program where everything was written out like that. I just can't imagine that Bach would work all this, you know, and set all these and not use them. You know, he was practical as well.
So where would Bach have gotten some of his ideas for the kinds of music we just were listening to?
Yeah, of course, in the canon at Bach's time was Heinrich Schütz, who we know Bach knew a lot about. Schütz conveniently was born 100 years before Bach. So Bach is 1685, Schütz is 1585. As a young man, Schütz goes to Italy and studies with Gabrielli, and then goes back to Germany where he was born, and is running the musical scene pretty much at Dresden, which was, of course, an opulent, wonderful city. In mid-career, however, the 30 Years' War begins, and Schütz is mid-career, and, you know, the population is decimated, the musical population is decimated, it's a horrible time. And I believe the pieces that we're doing here are from a little bit later in his career, and they hit the title, The Little Spiritual Concerts. It has to do with how few performers there are. There was a lot of music written for solo at this time, and not large choral things. So it's a reflection of the shrunken musical scene at the time. But it has nothing to do with the joy that's in the music. It's some of the most joyous music ever written. And this one is in the beautiful sunny key of G major, and it is a great thanks to God for taking care of us.
Allein Gott in dir sei Herr und Dank für seine Gnade. Darum das nimmer und nimmer mehr uns Frieden kann und Frieden kein Schein schade. Ein wohlgefallen Gott, ein
loben preisen,
wir loben preisen,
wir loben preisen, wir loben preisen, anbeten
wir deine Ehre,
für deine Ehre, wir dir danken.
Aus Bruder, Vater, ewig dich regieren.
Hast du Gott, Vater, ewig mich regiere.
Hast du Gott, Vater, ewig mich regiere.
Alles, alles andere.
Ganz ungemessen.
Ganz ungemessen.
Ganz ungemessen
ist deine Macht.
Ist deine Macht.
Wortgeschicht, was dein Will hat gedacht.
Wortgeschicht, was dein Will hat gedacht.
Hol uns des Feinen,
hol uns des Feinen,
hol uns des
Feinen, des Feinen, Herr.
O Jesu Christus, Sohn einig geboren, Sohn einig geboren, deines himmlischen Vaters.
As you promised, Trevor, a bright, sunny key, G, delivering some real sunshine.
Right.
And in particular of that work by Schütz. Now, in terms of the genre, what would that actually, it's not a motet, is it? Because it's not on a, does it have to be on a biblical text to be a motet?
Oh, man.
All right, we need to get technical
Peter,
there.
He knows. Right.
But what would you actually, in a sense, it's a, I mean, it's a Christmas song. It's about the birth of Christ, but.
Almost a hymn anthem, although I'm
more of a hymn.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Allein Gott in der Höhe is a Lutheran hymn, so you know we're well past the Reformation at this point. I mean, I guess it would have been considered a sort of a concerto almost, although it's not really in that form.
Yeah. And it's full of all sorts of weird little notes that are borrowed from modes. It might be a writing out of a form of what they call musica ficta, in which people would, you would bend notes and go to another mode and then come back into the main thing. I mean, there are moments in here where, for instance, that there's F naturals and F sharps very close to each other, like that. They're happening just bang, 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 like that. Almost, if you look at it harmonically, it'd be called like a cross relation or something like that. But it adds such wonderful color. And it's actually kind of related to the way jazzers still do scales, with introducing chromatic notes out of nowhere and then patching them up right afterwards. So I think it's also just gorgeous,
gorgeous writing.
It is, and it's really gorgeous to hear the four voices with the harpsichord. That's a nice combination. I know we're going to be moving to the piano in a little later in our explanation of Christmas music when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Piercing, searching, biting cold. The owner of one scant young nose, gnawed and mumbled by the hungry cold as bones are gnawed by dogs, stooped down at Scrooge's keyhole to regale him with a Christmas carol. But at the first sound of, "God bless you, merry gentlemen, may nothing you dismay," Scrooge seized the ruler with such energy of action that the singer fled in terror. That's from Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. With us is Trevor Stevenson and four singers, Rachel Edie Warwick, Jessica Timmon, Peter Gritt, and Nathan Krieger, as we explore Christmas music. Trevor, what Christmas Carol is to literature, where it's performed all over the world at Christmas, it seems to me Nutcracker Suite is to music. And we open the hour with a little bit of you at the piano. Right. With the Sugar Plums. Tell us about the arrangement you were playing.
Right. This is, of course, the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, one of the most and justly famous Christmas pieces by Tchaikovsky. And Tchaikovsky was, of course, a wonderful pianist. He probably wrote the whole Nutcracker ballet at the piano. And this is his own transcription, which he published as well. Maybe it's the original and the orchestra is the transcription. It's beautiful writing, and I think it gives a little bit of a window onto his world at the piano as well. So this is the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy in the original key of E minor.
Which originally would have had a part for the, or originally in the orchestral score, would have had that part for the Celeste.
Right, which of course is a magic moment. When I was a kid, I wore out the record on this piece. I think I wore the grooves completely thin at this point. I actually suffered the illusion that it was not written by a human being. And even for Tchaikovsky, it's an amazing moment. There's something about the way the harmonization works.
The piano actually reminds me, hearing the original piano version, I'll call it, remind me a little bit of the difference between, say, you know, the Ravel and the Mussorgsky pictures at an exhibition. It's got some interesting things going on there, some almost rough notes that come in.
Right, and things, he really is playing with the resonance of the piano, and I think every note in it is designed to set it off. Even this passage, which is a harp-like, he says harp-like.
Right.
Yeah, it's very pianistic. Yeah.
And then he's got, in the orchestral version, what is it, a bass clarinet that comes in there so atmospherically.
Right, which is the...
Yeah, yeah.
But it works beautifully on the piano. It sounds nice that way. Now we've got our four singers back up with you at the piano. What are we going to hear for four singers and piano?
Right, this is I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day, and a wonderful poem by Longfellow, and written, and this was written during the Civil War. The poem has, of course, just a great sorrow and despair built right into it. I think it's from the war. There is the thought that there will never be peace on earth, that hate will win out. That comes in the third verse. And then the bells, it's the sound of the bells that brings the heart back and says that good will triumph in the end. And so this Longfellow's poem, a fellow named J. Baptiste Calkin wrote the music in the 1870s. I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day.
Longfellow's appearance in a Christmas song.
Exactly right. Yeah, just a very strong poem, I think.
But the,
and of course,
the
full of that chewy 19th century harmony, you know, with all the half steps and the sliding around in the
right.
middle.
Right. Oh, very 19th century, that's right. Yeah.
What was it?
I was just going to say, with some of the Christmas carols, there's so many different variations, or, you know, you'll hear something and it's kind of like the one you remember hearing, but something's a little different in the tune. I know we're going to end with what we know as Jingle Bells, but it's not going to be necessarily the one we know, right?
But wait, yes, exactly right.
It's going to be the real one.
The real
this
one?
Is the real, right? This is the
well,
original from the 1850s.
Yeah, we usually just hear the chorus of this song, and occasionally you hear the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And it was written by John Pierpont, who was would be in the Confederate Army, I guess, after he wrote this, when he was perhaps secondarily known as being the uncle of J.P. Morgan,
that's
the great
remarkable.
Financier.
And what are we going to hear musically? What should we listen to?
Well, the chorus, the melody and the harmony go in a completely different direction with the well, the chord progression is probably more related to heart and soul in some ways in this. And the verse is pretty much the same. We'll also hear this very clever second verse. Nathan will sing that as a solo about the lean and lank horse and getting in the snowdrift and all of that. It's a very silly song in A flat, kind of a wild key.
Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh, o'er the hills we go, laughing all the way.
two ago, I thought I'd take a ride, and soon Miss Fanny Bright was seated by my side. The horse was lean and lank, misfortune seemed his lot. He got into a drifted bank, and we got upset.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. What a joy it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what joy it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
I think the, what shall we say, the rediscovery of the piano part is the real gem there, Trevor. Wow.
That's wild. Almost like a Joplin, right?
Yeah.
That stuff. What is that? Right.
But also with
it's the jingle bells. It's the tinkling.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah. Sure.
The chorus, it's almost operatic the way the voices come in there.
I never thought that it is. It's an opera chorus, right there.
It's not the kind you hear in the shopping mall. Not that jingle bells. No. No,
well, different. The harmonies, are something we're not accustomed to either. Usually it's just on kind of straight ahead, flat. The horse certainly doesn't get wandering off into the snowdrift.
Right, right. Yeah, this comes. Yeah, this actually walks through F minor in the chorus, which is, that's your snowdrift. Yeah.
And I wonder if we can go out on a repeat of that song after I reintroduce and thank all of the five of you for being with us. Our guest at the keyboard has been Trevor Stevenson. And with him have been Rachel Edie Warwick as soprano, Jessica Timmon, alto, Peter Gritt, tenor, and Nathan Krieger, bass. And this is University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, and let's go out on Jingle Bells.
And Merry Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Chorus?
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what joy it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what joy it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.